afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we take your calls during this hour to see if you have anything we can help you with in terms of your curiosity about the Bible or the Christian faith. If you have questions about these things, you can call, and we can try to help you out. If you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to call about that, feel free to do that. You're welcome here anytime with that kind of call as well. Here's the number to call. Our lines are all wide open. That usually doesn't remain true for very long. So if you want to get in while the getting is good, you can get in right now at this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I have a question here that was written in from Sandra. She said, Steve, I don't understand why God makes himself so hard for the unbeliever to recognize. If God really wants everyone to know him, it seems that he would have unmistakable signs to persuade the doubters. Can you clarify this matter for me? Well, of course, I can't answer for God concerning all of his decisions and all of his policies, but in this particular case, I don't see any particular problem, because the purpose that God has in making human beings is not just to get a whole bunch of people to believe in him. He could have programmed that into people if he wanted to, just like he programs it into the animals to do the things that he wants them to do. They have instincts for that. If God wanted to make sure that every human being would believe in him, he could have just kind of factory installed faith and belief and loyalty to him into the human creature. But see, what God was doing in creating man was something, something a little more nuanced than that. Sure, he wants everyone to know him, and he wants everyone, more importantly, to love him. It's one thing to know there is a God, and there's a lot of people who know there's a God but don't love him. So getting, for God just to expose himself and say, hey, I'm here, would not necessarily guarantee that people would love him. For one thing, what could he do to guarantee even that they would know him? If the skies pulled back and God, flashed a huge sign across the sky in neon, hey, I'm God and I'm here, I'm sure that there are those who would still, chalk this up to some kind of a hallucination, something like that. There are people who would simply not believe it. In John chapter 12, it says that God spoke audibly with a booming voice from heaven to Jesus when Jesus was in a crowd. And when it tells us what God said, but then it says, some said it thundered. Now, that's interesting, because some people understood it was a voice. Other people just explained it away as thunder. Now, what that means is there was actually a case in this instance where God did manifest himself. You might think uncontroversially that his existence was real. And yet there were those who explained it away as a natural phenomenon, as some people would definitely do because of the nature of their worldview. You can't just make people believe without forcing them. And that's not something you can do to make friends. You don't want, for example, I would like, let me put it this way. When I was single, there was more than one instance where I would have liked for someone to be in love with me, but they weren't. Now, I would have liked it if they were, but I couldn't make them be, and I didn't want to force it, not that it's even possible to. But, even if you could force it, that's not necessarily that's not the conditions on which you would like to have a partner. You want them to choose you. They want them to choose you because they find something about you that they admire or like or love, rather than that they had no choice. And that's how God is engineered people. He doesn't want to bully us or overwhelm us. He has given very many evidences that he exists. Anyone who's open-minded and isn't trying to avoid the knowledge of God can easily deduce that there is a God from the information in the universe. The DNA is a code of information. Anyone can tell that there's a God, an intelligent designer who put that code together, unless they don't want to. And if they don't want to, well, there's not much more he should do about it. If people don't want to know him, why should he just, peel the heavens back and say, hey, you don't want me, but here I am. That's not the terms on which God is looking for friendships and people to love him. If people want God, if they're not trying to avoid God, they can easily deduce from what he has already shown that he's there. Romans chapter 1 said the invisible things of God are clearly seen, being manifest in the things that are made, so that they are without excuse. So the problem here is not that God hasn't done enough to let people know that he's there. It's that people haven't responded enough to the amount that he has given them evidence of his existence. Why should he give them more? They're not very reliable or very responsible with the evidence he's already given them. Why should he entrust them with more? Why should he make himself more vulnerable? Why should he make himself more manifest to people who already don't care about him, don't want him? So that would be my answer, Sandra, concerning that question. Let's talk to Kevin from McMinnville, Oregon, next. Kevin, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Hey, my question lies, once again, I'm still doing some studies on church history and so forth. And
Kevin, you're not very loud. Are you talking right into your phone?
Well, maybe not. Here we go. Is
okay.
That better?
It could be, yeah. I just know that I was having a hard time hearing you.
Okay. I'm still doing the study on, you know, the concept of church history and looking at the early church fathers and trying to obviously compare all millennialism with, you know, what I believe and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What is the earliest church father that you would accredit spiritualizing to?
Well, spiritualizing in the sense of the millennium or spiritualizing in general?
Well, spiritualizing in a general sense, in a sense, but also, you know, the birth of all millennialism and so forth.
Yeah. Well, see, yeah, all millennialism is a system that does spiritualize certain things in the scriptures, but then everybody spiritualizes some things in the scriptures. When Jesus is called the Lamb, we don't consider he's literally a lamb. That's a spiritual thing. He's the spiritual. It has a spiritual meaning to us. He's not an actual lamb. And as far as spiritualizing things in the Bible, that's been done as long as there's been Christians. Certainly the apostles did it in the New Testament. And as far as church fathers go, Justin Martyr, for example, I don't know that he was the earliest, but he's one I've read most recently. Justin Martyr, spiritualized Israel as the church, or considered church to be Israel now. And that's usually called spiritualizing. But that was a fairly universal position of the church fathers. Now, this is not the same thing as saying they were all millennial, because they weren't. Justin Martyr was premillennial, but he still spiritualized Israel and considered the church to be Israel today. So what, you know, in the dispensational view, you know, of course it's premillennial, but it's not just premillennial. It's premillennial with an added feature, and that is that Israel continues to be God's chosen people, even despite their rejection of Christ. And they will be prominent during the millennial age, according to dispensationalism. That was not held by Justin Martyr or any of the early premillennialists. That's why a difference is usually made in speaking about premillennialism between what they call historic premillennialism and dispensational premillennialism. Dispensationalism has this prominence of Israel, whereas the historic premillennialists in the first three centuries didn't.
Okay, now, so you see, you gave an example of, I wouldn't have called that spiritualizing.
Okay.
What would you call
spiritualizing?
Well, take for instance, let me give you three examples. One, okay. A simile would be Israel is like a vine.
Okay, that's a metaphor.
That's a simile, because it's like as. Mm-hmm. A metaphor would be like Jesus is a vine.
Okay.
Okay, that direct and so forth. Spiritualizing is, let me go back. Israel is like a vine, and then Israel is a vine. Those one would be, the first would be a simile, the other would be a metaphor.
Correct.
And then spiritualizing is that Israel is the church, which is a vine. So when Israel, in both the first two, Israel remains Israel. In the second, the third one, Israel is now not Israel. Israel is the church. Therefore, you're spiritualizing Israel to be the church.
But how
that
are
would
you
be the difference between that.
Okay. Yeah, I would say that the whole Bible, Old and New Testament, spiritualizes Israel. If we mean by that, that the people of Israel in the Old Testament are identified by their spiritual traits rather than their physical traits. Like Paul said, he is not a Jew who's one outwardly, but he's a Jew who's one inwardly. Circumcision is not outward of the flesh, but of the heart. And in saying that, I think Paul was not saying this is a new situation. I think he's saying it's always been that way, that Israel has always been defined as that nation that whose God is the Lord. Blessed is the nation whose God
right.
is Yahweh. And so the people of
Israel stay Israel in that case. In other words, he who is a Jew is one inwardly, meaning you are Jews, actual Jews, not a Gentile, but a Jew. You're only a Jew if you're one inwardly.
Okay, so that means then that a person of Jewish ancestry who isn't a Jew inwardly isn't really part of the spiritual Israel, right?
Well, you're right. They're not part of a spiritual Israel.
Okay, so then we agree about that.
Not an Israelite who is spiritual.
We agree that, well, okay, well, let me put it this way. In the Old Testament, when the nation of Israel was formed, which was at Mount Sinai, it was a mixed multitude, right? It was not just Jews.
Right.
It was not just Israel. There were Gentiles too.
Right.
Now, what were the conditions that God gave for being his people and his nation there? He said, if you continue in my words and obey my covenant, then you'll be a peculiar people to me. You'll be a holy nation and so forth. So God established them as his own peculiar people and special chosen nation based on their obedience to the covenant. Now, as we go through the law in the Old Testament, we see that the obedience to the covenant meant you don't worship other gods and that you be circumcised and you keep Sabbath and Passover and things like that.
Right.
So a Gentile could do that. A Gentile could become part of Israel by getting circumcised and all of that. He'd be like a native of the land, it says in the law. So he'd be just like a Jew. He'd be a part of Israel. Okay, now a Gentile could be part of Israel, and a Jew could not be. If that Jew worshipped other gods, they'd be cut off from the people, it says in the law. It also says if they commit murder, they'll be cut off from the people and so forth. So a Jewish person could be a non-Israelite by the terms that God defined of being an Israel. And a Gentile could be an Israelite. So, and this was the case in the Old Testament. There were many Jews like Korah and his rebels who were cut off and they were not part of Israel anymore. And likewise, there were Gentiles like Ruth and Rahab who became part of Israel. So in other words, Israel, even in the Old Testament, was defined by spirituality, not by race. If a Ruth or a Rahab could be part of Israel and didn't have any racial Israelite in them, that means being in Israel was a spiritual, not a physical definition.
Well, now, I wouldn't quite go that far, because quite frankly, there was times when Israel, not all Israel were bowing the knee to God, so therefore, but he still sees the people of Israel as Israel, even if they need to repent. He doesn't look at them as saying, well, you're not repentant, so you're no longer Israel. He's looking at them, yes, you're my people, and now I'm going to get you, and I'm going to send chastisement
Kevin,
get you to turn back.
Kevin,
that
are you...
That would be the difference, wouldn't you
say? If you would read the promises, and I know you have because you're a Bible teacher yourself, if you would read all the promises in the Old Testament that God made to Israel, you'll see that dozens of times he mentions these promises are for the remnant, for the remnant, for the remnant. And the remnant are defined as those who are faithful to him. And therefore it is true there were times when the nation of Israel, ethnic Israel, was not physically disbanded by God, even though they were in rebellion. But it was still the case that only the faithful remnant within them had any claim to the promises of the covenant, because the covenant is what defines them as the faithful remnant. And then when Jesus met in the upper room with the faithful remnant, he established a new covenant. As Jeremiah said, he would make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. But, of course, that's the faithful remnant. And they were in the upper room with Jesus at the Last Supper, and he established that. Now, Paul indicates in Romans 11 that this olive tree, Israel, has experienced a demographic reshuffling because there are Jews who believe, who are like branches on the tree, and there are Jews who do not believe, who have been cut off. They're like branches cut off from the tree. They're not part of Israel anymore. Okay? And he said there are Gentiles. Well, they may be called Jews, but they're not part of Israel. They're Jewish by race.
He calls them at the beginning of the chapter. He does refer to them as Israel. He says not all Israel.
But Kevin, hey, I'm not going to fall for that one. Everyone, a dispensation, so I'll just bring this up. Israel is used a number of ways in Romans 9 through 11. And dispensationalists say, no, it's always ethnic Israel. Not always. When Paul said they are not all Israel who are of Israel in Romans 9, 6, he was saying that some of the people who are ethnic Israel are not really Israel in the sense that matters. And he's pointing out when he explains that as the olive tree, the Jews who do not believe are the branches that have been cut off the tree. They're not on the tree anymore. Okay, they don't belong to Israel anymore. Why? Because they're not Jews inwardly. Earlier in the same book, Paul said they're not Jews if they're not circumcised in the heart. They're not a true Jew. He is not a Jew who's one outwardly. So Paul has made it very clear, a person who's Jewish and isn't a Jew inwardly, has not received Christ, is not circumcised in their heart. They're like a branch that was once part of the tree, but they're cut off now. But he said that Gentiles can be added in. And this really isn't any different than it was in the Old Testament. Because as we pointed out, in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant, a Jew could be cut off for his unfaithfulness, and a Gentile could be included by his faithfulness. It's all the same in the New Covenant. There's a New Covenant with the house of Israel now, but the conditions are the same. Those who are faithful to the New Covenant are part of the tree, whether they're Jew or Gentile. Those who are unfaithful to the New Covenant are not on the tree. They've been cut off, whether they're Jew or Gentile. They're not there. So this is how I understand Israel. Now, I don't expect you to agree with me because you're a dyed-in-the-wool dispensationalist and have been for many decades, but this is how I see it, and I don't think there's a better way to see that.
Okay. Are you there?
Uh-huh.
What I would see, I mean, I agree with you a lot on what you're saying there, except for I would say that the scriptures better present consistently in the Old Testament and in Romans chapter 9, 10, 11, as Israel as being Israel, ethnic Israel that involves just, I guess, like the United States, we have lots of different nationalities, you know, or races or whatever, and one nation type of thing. And in this case, Israel is made up of a multi-group, but they are still Israel, whether they are the stranger that comes in and then is adapted into it, or they actually born. But after that, there is out of that Israel, there is the remnant of them in which God gets his remnant out of Israel. And I think that's clear as far as that is concerned. Now,
I'm going to let you have the last word on that, and you just had it. We've been talking for a third of the program, and my lines have been full the whole time, so I need to take another caller. But, Kevin, let me just say this. You may not have noticed, I have recently replaced my old series at the website, What Are We to Make of Israel? It used to be four badly recorded lectures that were interrupted by students that you could hardly hear on the recording and things like that. It was really a bad set because of the recording quality. I've re-recorded the set, but it's longer now. There's like, I don't know, eight lectures up there already now. And there's a couple more to come. But if you listen to those, or if our audience will listen to those, you'll get the full answer. That is my full answer to your position and the things you're saying. I don't think that you're taking Paul correctly, and you don't think I am. And therefore, you know, without going into extremely great detail with a lot of different relevant scriptures that you're thinking about and that I'm thinking about, which we simply cannot do on a Q&A format like a program like this, I can direct you to, and Kevin, you know where this is, but for our listeners who don't, it's thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and you go to the topical lectures link. Now, these lectures are free. They're MP3 files you can just listen to or download. And under the topical lectures, there's a series called What Are We to Make of Israel? As I said, right now, there's eight lectures at it, and they go through. I go through the Abrahamic covenant, the Sinaitic covenant, the Davidic covenant, the New Covenant, And most of the passages that are sought to be about the future of Israel, I talk about those things, and I give the non-dispensational view. So, Kevin, I know that you've heard my old set, but this new set is very up-to-date. I'm still, in fact, in the process of teaching it one lecture a month. Anyway, Kevin, I've been very generous with my time with you, and you can call again, of course, anytime. We'll talk again.
All right.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for calling.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, we'll talk next to Ken from Winters, California. Ken, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I was wondering, what year was it that John was on the Isle of Patmos?
Well, that's disputed. That's disputed. We don't have any external certain information about that, except we do have a statement by Irenaeus, who wrote about 100 years after that time. And he thought, well, it seems that he may have thought that John was on Patmos during the latter part of Domitian's reign, which would be probably around 95-96 AD. I say it seems that he thought that because the main statement that Irenaeus made about it is a little ambiguous. Some people don't think so, but I do. I find it quite ambiguous. And so it's possible that Irenaeus said that John was on Patmos near the end of Domitian's reign. If so, I believe that Irenaeus was the earliest to say so. Now, there are some people who believe that the evidence in the book of Revelation would point to an earlier date than that, that he was on the island of Patmos in the 60s instead of the 90s.
Okay, because I was wondering, the part of Revelation that speaks about the mark of the beast and nobody being able to buy or sell without it, I don't really see that that's ever actually been fulfilled, and I was wondering how you accounted for that part.
Sure. Well, the truth is, I think that that really depends on how you picture the fulfillment of it. If you're picturing a time when some world dictator is going to assign a credit number to be tattooed or implanted on the hand or the forehead of every world citizen, and without that, they cannot do transactions, they can't buy anything, they can't sell anything. If that's what you're picturing there, then as far as I know, you're right. It hasn't happened. And that is, it's the fact that dispensationalists and popular teachers think that it's supposed to happen that way that makes them believe that they should take it in a futuristic way. The real question has got to be is, wait, where are we getting this idea that it's supposed to mean that? Now, someone says, well, we're taking it literally. No, that's not taking it literally. For one thing, there are three elements of what I just described as a scenario that most people assume. One is a world dictator, a man ruling and dictating in the world. Secondly, giving a credit number on the hand or on the forehead, either in the form of a chip or a tattoo. And the third thing is, not being able to do any transactions, economic transactions. How much of that is literally stated in Revelation? Well, the whole picture is in Revelation 13, but who's the beast? The beast isn't said to be a man. The beast is said to be an animal with seven heads and 10 horns. Now, if we're going to be literal, if we're going to take this literal, then an animal with seven heads and 10 horns is going to be the one doing this, not a man. Now, everyone would say, well, that's ridiculous. Of course, it's not an animal. It's a man. You need to understand that. Well, of course, I understand what they're saying, but it's not literal then. Because if we're going to take it literally, it says an animal. It does not say a man. Now, I also don't see any reason to interpret it as a man. Because the animal in question in Revelation 13 comes out of the sea, just like four animals came out of the sea in Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, Daniel saw in a dream four beasts come one right after another out of the sea, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a beast with 10 horns. The beast in Revelation comes out of the sea, and it's like a leopard. It's got the mouth of a lion, the feet of a bear, and it's got 10 horns and seven heads. So we've got a beast here that's a conglomerate, a combination of all four of Daniel's beasts, and none of those beasts are individual men. The beasts in Daniel are kingdoms. This is a combination of all the kingdoms. There's certainly no reason to believe this is a man. It's more like a political conglomerate, a political system of some kind. Now, I don't have to go into detail about who I think that is, but the point is, anyone who says that this passage is talking about a world dictator, a man, is not taking anything literal in the Bible. There's no literal reference to this beast being a man. Okay? Secondly, there's no reference to giving anyone a credit number on their forehead or on their hand. At the end of Revelation chapter 13, we're told that the name of the beast or his mark or the number of his name is issued and put on the hand or the forehead of everybody. Okay? Now, the name of the beast is no doubt the same name, no matter who gets it. We're not talking about everyone getting their own personalized number, that like your bank account number or your Social Security number. Everyone's got a different one. In Revelation, everybody's getting the same number. It's the number of the name of the beast, 666. There's not a variety of numbers being given, but it's the beast's name on the forehead or the hand. It's as if everyone has his brand, like cattle are branded and have the brand of their owner on them. So these people are branded, like slaves were branded in the Roman Empire. Sometimes they were branded on their forehead or on their hand, especially if they'd been runaway slaves and been recaptured. They were treated this way. And so having the name or the number or the brand of somebody on your forehead means you're their slave. But all the cattle on the Circle K ranch have the Circle K on them. They don't have their own numbers and their own individuality. Likewise, the number of the beast is not said to be a different number for every person, but it's the same number for every person. It's the name of the beast that we're talking about. And it can be a number or a name or a mark. So far, two of the three things that people think they're getting from Revelation 13 are not even there. Revelation 13 does not mention a man ruling the world. It does not mention a credit number or an individualized number that each person has with their personal information on it. It doesn't say that at all. In fact, it says the opposite. And what about the third point, that they can't buy or sell without this number because it's a cashless society? Well, it does say that they can't buy or sell without this number. It doesn't say that it's because it replaces cash by any means, not the least bit. How would the name of the beast on your forehead replace cash in any kind of a transaction? The reason you can't buy or sell is no doubt because people boycott you if you're a nonconformist. When everybody is serving the same government entity, when everyone's serving the same idol, and you are not, and you're marching to a different drummer, and you don't have his brand because you're not his servant, well, then you'll be persecuted. One form of persecution that's very commonplace in history is people won't buy or sell with you. They won't do business with you because they don't like your position. They don't. I mean, this recently happened with Chick-fil-A, because the owner said that he believed in traditional marriage. So a whole bunch of people didn't want to buy anything from Chick-fil-A anymore. There's an example. And there's been many other examples like that throughout history. Now, to say that you will be persecuted and one form of that persecution is given, which is a boycott, to me, to just give that one form of persecution to represent all kinds of persecution, including different kinds than boycotts, is similar to Revelation when it talks about martyrs. It talks about all of them being beheaded. I saw the souls of those who were beheaded. What? Well, what about those who were crucified or burned at the stake or hacked into pieces or, run through with swords? Or didn't they get to rule with Christ too? No, only those who were beheaded. Well, that's silly, of course. Obviously, those who are beheaded for Christ are martyrs just the same, no more, no less than those who are otherwise killed for Christ. When Revelation talks about those who are beheaded, it simply is talking about martyrs, period. One kind of martyrdom is being mentioned to stand for the whole category. Likewise, in talking about persecution, boycott is one kind of persecution. It is mentioned in Revelation 13, I think, to represent persecution in general. People will ostracize you. People will not want to do business with you if you're not a conformist, if you're not marching to the same drummer, if you're not a slave of the beast like they are. And so, I don't think there's anything in that chapter that says the things that our popular teachers tell us. Our popular teachers tell us that there's supposed to be this credit number that's issued to everybody and you can't buy or sell because it's a cashless society and the Antichrist is doing this. And well, none of that is really stated there. So when you say, when did this happen? I think it's happened throughout history. I think throughout history, godly people who don't serve the beast system, I think they've been persecuted by people who do. And that's what I think Revelation's talking about.
Okay, well, thank you for that explanation. I appreciate it.
Okay, Ken. Thanks for your call. I appreciate the question. All right. Let's talk to Dennis from the Central Coast, California. Dennis, every time he calls, has a different location because he travels. He's a salesman. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
It's a different Dennis. I'm sorry. It's a different Dennis. I have another Dennis who calls me from all over the place in the Central Coast. I assume.
Oh, no.
My mistake. Go ahead.
You get around. I usually call you from home.
Yeah. It's the other Dennis who gets around. Go ahead.
First chapter of John, at the end, primarily at the end, he's talking to Nathaniel, and he says, you know, you'll see greater things. He says, you said, I'm the Lord or something because I
saw you under the fig tree.
Yeah. So then, but he says, you'll see the heavens open, and the Son of Man and angels coming up and down on the Son of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, how many times I've read that and just gone right over it.
So what does it mean?
What does it mean?
Yeah, well, it's a reference back to Genesis chapter 28, of course, when Jacob was fleeing from his brother Esau, and he was traveling for several days to get to Paddan Aram, and one night when he slept on a stone out under the stars, he had a dream, and in the dream there was this staircase or this ladder that had its foot on the ground and its top in heaven, and God was at the top, and Jacob was at the bottom. And it says in his dream he saw the angels of God ascending and descending upon the ladder. Now, Jesus said, you shall see the heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man, that is himself. So this reference to the angels of God ascending and descending is a direct quote from Genesis 28. And what does it come from? It comes from this vision, this dream, about a ladder on earth that reaches to heaven, which is clearly the access point between heaven and earth. The angels themselves, when they travel between heaven and earth, are traveling over this thoroughfare. And I guess one could deduce that if someone wished to go up to heaven, they should go on the same route. That's the ladder that gets there. Now, the point here is that Jacob's ladder in his dream represented the contact point and the access point between heaven and earth, between God and the realm of men. And Jesus said, you know, Nathaniel, you're going to come to see me that way. You're going to see me as the one upon whom the angels of God ascend and descend. That is, I'm Jacob's ladder. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me, as he said later on in the same book, in chapter 14 and verse 6. He's saying essentially that if you're looking for the access between heaven and earth, I'm right here. I'm the access. I'm on earth, but I reach to heaven, and people can access heaven, can access God through me. And so I think that that's what Jesus is saying. Now, of course, he spoke it as if Nathaniel was going to see some kind of a vision or a dream, sort of like Jacob did. We don't know if Nathaniel ever had such a vision or a dream of seeing heaven open, but he might have, but it's not necessary to think so, because sometimes the Bible talks about seeing things when it's really meaning seeing it in your mind or understanding or grasping it. For example, in Hebrews, it says, we don't yet see all things put under man, but we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor. Well, I don't see him, not with my eyes, but I do perceive him. I do believe that about him. And that's the way that the word see is often used in Scripture, that you see it, as it were, by faith. You see it in your mind's eye. You get the revelation of it. You grasp it. You perceive it. And that's what I think Jesus is saying, is the time will come, Nathaniel, when you'll perceive me as being the very access point between heaven and earth, just like Jacob's ladder and the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending. Nathaniel might never have seen that with his eye, but he would come to understand Jesus as having that particular role.
Excellent.
Okay, Dennis, I appreciate your call.
The rest of that chapter seemed like it was pretty straightforward, factual, and all of a sudden, with your explanation there, there's something very esoteric
It is a little esoteric, but of course it would be understandable to anyone who was like Nathaniel or the Jewish listeners there who were familiar with Jacob's ladder and that story.
All right.
Okay, Dennis, thanks for your call. I appreciate it very much. All right, I'm going to talk to Ed from Phoenix, Arizona next. And we've got a line open for you if you'd like to be on the program. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. And if you have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith, we can talk about it here. If you disagree with the host, we can talk about that too. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Ed, thanks for calling. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I have a quick comment before I get into my question, and
okay.
It has to do with you get so many questions about end times, obviously, but just I wanted to add one additional item to the mark of the beast. My understanding is that you would have to accept that willingly as well. It wouldn't be something that we would be deceived necessarily into and not know what it means. You would have to obviously, it would have to be anti-Christ. Whatever action or whatever they are asking you to do, this beast, it would have to be something that Christians would recognize as being anti-Christ. That's correct, right?
Well, of course, absolutely. See, I believe that taking the mark of the beast just is symbolic for having your loyalty to him as your master, and you're his servant. And you see, in Revelation, after it talks about people having the beast's name on their forehead, right after that, in chapter 14, verse 1, it says, God saw God's people, the 144,000, with their father's name on their forehead. So there's two groups of people, and servants have their master's name stamped on their forehead. The servants of God have God's name. The servants of Satan have the beast's name. And this is not literally the case. It's simply the case that some people are the servants of God, and observably so. Some are the servants of Satan, and observably so. But you're right. I mean, it's an important thing. Some people think, you know, that if they were held down and forcibly given the mark against their wishes or something, however they picture this thing taking place, that somehow they've got to go to hell, because the Bible says that whoever takes the mark of the beast will, you know, the wrath of God will burn upon him, and he'll be tormented in the presence of the Lamb and of the holy angels. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast or take the mark of the beast, it says in Revelation 14:11. So I mean, some people say, oh, no, what if I don't want to take the mark of the beast, but what if someone makes me do it, or what if I get tricked into it? Well, when you think about it, when you think about the mark of the beast being simply a matter of, as is popularly taught, and I don't accept, but it is popularly taught, the mark of the beast is really just basically an exchange of a cash-based economy for a credit-based economy where the credit card number is on your forehead or your hand. Now, I don't see it that way. The Bible doesn't say that. But it would be kind of a strange thing if it did say that, because that would mean that God's going to send people to hell for no other reason than that they paid for their groceries with a credit number than with cash. As if the means of purchasing things at the market is the deciding factor of whether you go to heaven or hell. I mean, what kind of teaching is that? What kind of doctrine would that lead to? If, you know, God's going to send people to hell because they paid for the groceries with a number that was tattooed on their hand instead of with cash or a credit card. That's so bizarre. No, the whole idea of taking the mark of the beast means your loyalty is to him. Basically, you are his servant, and that's why you have his brand on you.
So, I agree with you. Now, my question has to do, and I'll take your commentary off the air, but it has to do with going back in history after God created Adam and Eve. And obviously, there's a missing part of history there in the Bible where, you know, what happened to humanity. I wanted to get your opinion about, you know, obviously, people forgot about the one true God throughout, you know, the as the years and went by. And they started creating their own types of gods and idols. And it wasn't until God revealed himself to Abraham, I guess, to remind him, to let humanity know that he was the true God. What's your opinion about, you know, what happened during that time? Do you have any commentary, anything you would like to maybe touch on?
What do you mean that time? The time between Adam and Abraham?
Yeah. How the people that were living on the earth obviously forgot about God, some, and you know, obviously they went on to do their own, to worship their own God, and establish their own religions during that time. And it wasn't until, you know, Abraham, I guess, that he actually revealed himself. There is a missing, I guess what I'm trying to ask is there a missing, something missing there that we don't have in the Bible in Genesis that talks about that?
You mean, are you looking for some explanation for why they forgot God? Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, it's obviously we lived in, you know, Adam and Eve, they were in contact with God. And even after the fall, you know, God was involved. And then it just seems like, you know, civilizations, we went into all these different types, you know, of civilizations around the world. I mean, the Tower of Babel, obviously.
Okay. Well, let me just say this, that between the time of Adam and the time of Abraham was a period of 2,000 years. That's the same length of time as from the time of Christ to now, okay? So from Adam, who knew about God, and his kids who knew about God, to the time of Abraham, where a lot of people were pagans, that means that religions had, during that time, 2,000 years, apostate religions had occasion to form. Think of how many religions can come up, wrong religions, from people who know God in 2,000 years' time. For example, this country, our country, has forgotten God in a tenth of that time. You know, in 200 years and less, our nation has forgotten God. So it's not hard to imagine that in a period of 2,000 years, what is that, 50 generations or more? Depending on how you measure a generation, maybe 100 generations. That's a lot of time to drop the ball, to have the knowledge of God fall through the cracks, especially when most people, by nature, don't really want to retain God in their memory. I mean, there are people who do want to know God, but, I mean, look around you. Look around you. Even in our country right now, how many people really want to pursue God with all their heart and all their soul and all their mind? Now, some people might not want to be atheists, but they don't want to put God at the front. They don't want God to crowd out their entertainment choices or crowd out their employment choices or their marriage choices or their lifestyle choices. I mean, they don't want God to get involved there. They've got things ahead of God. And once you have something ahead of God, you already have idols. You already have a different religion, because the only true religion is where God is recognized for what he is, the creator of everything and the only proper object of loyalty and worship. And as soon as somebody puts their money or their car or their family or their job or their goals ahead of God, they've got an idol. They've got a new religion. It doesn't take long. I think that's the inclination of most men's hearts. So although we're not given much information about the period between Adam and Abraham, although it was 2,000 years, the main information we have about it includes the flood. You know, the flood happened about 3/4 of the way through that time. And by that time, the earth had become full of violence. Well, God washed those people away and spared Noah's family. But in the next, whatever it was, 500 years or so, Noah, well, his descendants also forgot God. It doesn't take long. It doesn't take more than a generation or two to totally forget God in a society. As long as those who love God are in the minority and those who hate God silence them or ignore them. And that's what's going on in our society. I think that probably has gone on in all societies. So I don't really see a need for, special, you know, theories about why the people forgot about God. I think that happens more naturally than remembering God does.
Right. And that's what I wanted you to talk about. You were able to answer the question without me having to properly ask the question. That's what I wanted you to.
That's why I'm the host. I can I can formulate the question that the caller doesn't know how to formulate. Yeah.
Exactly. I appreciate you very much, Steve. Thank you very much, and God bless you.
Okay, Ed. Thanks for calling. Bye now. Oh, by the way, Ed was calling from Phoenix. There is a plan in the works for me to come down to Phoenix sometime in January. I know it seems a long way off, but that's just the way it's being planned to come down and hold a meeting or meetings of some kind in Phoenix in January. So our Phoenix and Arizona audience there might want to just keep that in the back of your mind. I'd love to meet some of you guys like Ed and others who call here. And some of you who don't call, be glad to get to know some of you. Let's talk next to Camelia from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Camelia.
Hello, thank you. So I called with a question, but then I heard from the previous caller the discussion about getting the mark of the beast.
Uh-huh.
And it does make sense that, you know, not buying or selling would determine our eternity. But I think the Bible says that you cannot buy or sell. So I thought maybe that's significant of something.
Well, you know, it's what we're saying. What I was saying to an earlier caller is that I believe not being able to buy or sell because you don't follow the beast system is simply a way of saying that those who do follow the beast system will boycott you. This happened to the Jews in Germany before World War II. I mean, before the outright persecution of Jews in camps and things like that, their stores and shops and so forth were marked with the Star of David, and most Germans would not buy or sell from them, wouldn't do business with them because
right.
they were being persecuted. And this has happened to Christians as well. I mean, that happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany, but it's happened to Christians in many parts of the world and throughout history.
I see. So now to my question, can Christians lose their salvation?
Not if they don't want to.
I had a few discussions where people say once saved, always saved. But then, you know, just knowing that you're saved, would kind of mentally allow you to sin intentionally. So
well, that's how some people take it. Yeah, some people do interpret it that way. They figure I'm once saved, always saved, therefore I can just go out and sin because I'll always be saved. See, people like that don't know what saved means. And I think that that's partly the fault of the preachers in America. American evangelicalism has preached a changed gospel, a gospel of going to heaven, a gospel of getting a ticket to heaven. And so evangelism in this country has for a very long time suggested really salvation means that when you die, you go to heaven. And when you die, you don't go to hell. And if you're not saved, you're going to go to hell when you die. And if you are saved, you'll go to heaven when you die. And that's all they tell you. But that's only a part of it. There's a much more significant part of it, at least more significant to the present life. And that is salvation isn't just having a ticket to heaven. Salvation is having a restored relationship with God, which also entitles you to live with him forever after you die. But you live with him now too. If you have a restored relationship with God and you live with him on his terms in a relationship, then you have eternal life. This eternal life will continue even after your body dies, and will eventually you'll be resurrected and live forever with him in that form. But the point is, the gospel is not primarily about what happens after you die. And so when someone says, well, if I'm saved by grace and now I'm saved, that means when I die, I'm going to go to heaven. I can live like the devil now and I'll still go to heaven when I die. If that's what you think saved is, you don't know what the Bible says. The Bible does not describe saved people as people who live like the devil and go to heaven when they die. Saved people are people who've been restored to a proper relationship with God. Restored because they were not in a proper relationship with God before that. They were alienated from God. They were rebelling against God, either knowingly or unknowingly. When a person is deciding that they will run their life according to their own choices rather than God's, they're in rebellion against God because God has a claim on all of our choices. He has a claim on our lives. And therefore, if somebody is denying God that claim, he's the king. And the king says, hey, I own you. If you say, well, you're not going to own me, I'm going to make my own decisions. And that's what everyone does until they surrender to God. They're in rebellion against the king. They're not in a good relationship with God, and they're not going to go to heaven when they die either because they're alienated from God. The only way that people go to heaven when they die is if they have a restored relationship with God. Well, what's a relationship with God look like? Well, what's it look like when you've got a king? What's it look like when a rebel against the king has surrendered and received amnesty? Well, it means that he's now loyal to the king. It means he's now following the king. He's now obedient to the king. if a person is not living in obedience to God, they're not in a right relationship with him yet, because there's no such thing as a right relationship between a king and his subject where the subject is in rebellion, where the subject is disobeying. No, the only kind of relationship between a king and a subject that's right is for the subject to surrender and submit to the king and to obey the king. As long as people are not doing that, they're not in a relationship with God that would save anyone. They may pretend, and their preacher might tell them otherwise. Their preacher might say, no, you've got this salvation by faith. Well, what's salvation? You're talking about going to heaven when you die? That's not salvation. Salvation is being in a right relationship with God, which, of course, includes going to heaven when you die, because that's where God is. You're going to be with God because you're in a right relationship with him. But some people talk as if salvation is just a Christmas gift that you open the stocking on Christmas morning and you've got this gift called heaven. And it doesn't involve, you never meet Santa Claus. You never meet the person who put the gift in the bag or in the sock. You know, God is sort of like Santa Claus. No one ever sees him. No one ever has any contact with him. But lo and behold, Christmas morning, he dispenses gifts to you. And some people think that's how God is. You never meet him. You never have a relationship with him. But, you know, what do you know? He gave you a gift called heaven, a ticket to heaven in your stocking when you said, I believe in Jesus. That's not taught in the Bible. That's not salvation. Salvation is not a relationship like a child has with Santa Claus, whom he never sees or knows or speaks to. It's more like a child with his father. Salvation is being in right relationship with the father. That's what the prodigal son story tells us. The prodigal son was lost while he was alienated from his father. He was found and saved and came to life when he was restored to a right relationship with his father. That's what Jesus teaches about salvation. That's what the whole Bible teaches. So if someone says, can you lose your salvation? I think, first of all, well, what is salvation? If you're in a right relationship with God, you're surrendered to him, you're submitted to him, you love him, you trust him, you obey him, this is your life. This is who you are. You're a subject of the king, and you have embraced that with loyalty. Well, how could you lose your salvation? Well, only if you happen to be tempted away to become a rebel and to leave the king and to join the rebellion against him. In other words, if a person loves God, then they're not going to really want to give up their relationship with him. He's not going to break off the relationship with you. The ball is in your court. Just as coming to him, the ball was in your court, so staying with him, the ball is in your court. It's not as though he's not involved, though. The Bible says we're kept by the power of God through faith in 1 Peter 1:5, that we are kept, guarded by the power of God through faith. So we're secure as long as we have faith. It's through faith that we're kept by the power of God. Our faith. We trust, he keeps. And so our relationship is a relationship of trust and dependence upon him. And he's the powerful king who protects and rules us. And that's the relationship. You don't have to be afraid that you'll be somehow taken away. Jesus said, no one is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. He's greater than all. No one can pluck you out of his hand. But can you rebel against him? Well, sure, people do it all the time. People often rebel against God. And when they do, no one should tell them that they still have their salvation, because if you do, you're given a false assurance. There certainly is not the case. Nobody who is in rebellion against God has ever been described as saved in the Bible, because saved is the opposite of that. It's being submitted and loyal to God, trusting God, loving God, being faithful to God. That's what being saved is. It's a relationship, like a husband and wife relationship. It's a marriage, a covenant. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. We've been on the air for almost 18 years, but we pay for the radio time month by month, and that money comes from people like you. If you'd like to help us stay on the air where you're listening to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do that from our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.